This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Let's jump right into our week in review, which, of course, is all about all that snow, which crippled the city and made life hell for commuters.
I didn't think it was going to take 2 or 3 hours to get here, because if I would have known, I wouldn't have came.
Almost 80 inches of snow so far this winter, with another blizzard on the way this weekend.
Generally about 10 to 18 inches. The same areas that have been hit very hard this winter will get hit hardest again.
Oh boy. Also this week, no more hugs from Beverly Scott. Under pressure from the governor, the head of the T surprises just about everyone and quits.
I've described her as a superstar in the past. She has enormous shoes to fill. And the T is going to have some trouble recovering from the last 3 weeks.
Now Governor Charlie Baker is going to have to help fix the troubled agency.
Even if everything went exactly according to the T's plans, the T is still going to have huge issues with respect to the commuter rail, which has been demonstrated long before the snowstorm started.
So we'll size up how the state's political leaders have weathered the storms and what Beverly Scott's resignation means and the rest of the week's news with Boston University Communications Professor John Carroll. He's with us now. John, good to have you.
Good to be here.
And Jim Sturgis, Executive Director of the Pioneer Institute. Always good to have you, Jim.
It's good to be here.
So let's begin with Boston's public transportation woes and the sudden resignation this week of Beverly Scott, the general manager of the T. First, a little background. As we know, historic amounts of snow has slowed, crippled, and halted the T in recent days. Another blizzard coming this weekend. Governor Charlie Baker declared its performance unacceptable. Beverly Scott passionately defended her staff and record. Then just hours after the State Transportation Board gave her a unanimous vote of confidence, she quit. So the T is underfunded. Its cars are old and out of date with a multi-billion dollar maintenance backlog. Add to that now a new search for a new GM. So, Jim, I'll start with you, and I know you have a critique of the way the T has been managed, but first, were you surprised that Scott quit this week?
I was really surprised. And I think the fact is the woes of the T don't really rest primarily with her. I mean, our argument is that it really rests with the board. The board has been there. There have been oversight structures for quite some time that have allowed the T to overexpand, to do things like building the Greenbush line that has, I mean, frankly, a third of the riders on the Greenbush line came off of Maritime T services. They're going and buying a spur down to Foxborough where they don't have enough money to actually invest in maintenance. Things like they haven't tracked the maintenance they need to do over the past 5 years. The last time they did it was David D'Alessandro from the outside came in and said, I will go and figure out what you guys should have been doing. They stopped after that. Hmm. That's astounding to me. Hmm. Their bus maintenance is twice the cost of the national norm. These are things that really are not sustainable over time. And frankly, that's not her doing.
Yeah, that's. But to what extent do lawmakers have to bear some of the responsibility here? Because a lot of the expansion of the T, is it not true that it came from essentially a consent decree agreement in after the big dig and all that?
Absolutely, and I think that's a lot of the responsibility also rests with previous administrations and the legislature. Also, frankly, with advocacy groups that said, look, with the big dig, we're going to have all these mitigation projects, 14 of them, yeah, that were going to cost billions and billions of dollars. That was saddled onto the T. So definitely it rests elsewhere as well.
Well, we'll talk about what has to happen going forward. But, John, your quick response to Beverly Scott's resignation, it seemed like it shocked just about everybody.
Yeah, it did. And I think it is, you know, quit in a snit, I think, was pretty much what happened there. I've been riding the T for 40 years, and it's never been confused with a rapid transit system. But at this point, it's like somebody's hobby. It's just not feasible. It's the sort of the intersection of unreliable and inconceivable. And I think that, nobody's really grabbing onto this problem. Everybody's looking for somebody to scapegoat. There's a lot of places you can look and say, this was all wrong. Never should have done this. But the truth of the matter is Massachusetts has not been willing to invest in a system that will work. And it doesn't work when the weather's good. So when the weather turns bad this way, there are basic things like switch heaters. Nobody doesn't have switch heaters except us. So I think that it's a system that's doomed to failure, whatever happens. One last thing, I think Charlie Baker, threw Beverly Scott under the bus, except there was no bus running, which was unfortunate. But
threw her under a stalled bus.
He did that, and as somebody said, if you work for Charlie Baker now, you're really looking over your shoulder because he didn't hesitate at all to lay this off on somebody, and the governor is the one who should not be laying it off. The governor is the one who should be defending his people, and Beverly Scott's his person. He inherited her, but she's his person.
Now, I know a lot of people feel that way. Do you feel that way, Jim, that this was definitely a case of the governor throwing Beverly Scott under the bus? I mean, I know he expressed some criticism of the way the T was running.
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah. And look, the media loves the story, and if you watch the press conference that he was at, they kept asking him, should she resign? Should she resign? He could have been far more artful. My feeling is that probably he wanted to see her move on at some point. I don't think he expected that she would take a leave so early. One thing I would probably differ with John on, and that is I think historically the T has been underfunded. From 2000 to 2009, more or less, we drastically underfunded. But then we had a sales tax increase and we had a gas tax increase. And if you look at the numbers, we've gone from about $1.1 billion to about $1.9 billion in funding annually. That's a 73% increase in just over a decade. That's over 4% increase every year. When we moved to forward funding, which is essentially saying to the T, you have a budget now, which they didn't have before, we basically promised a 3% inflator every year. We have now lived up to that. I think the larger issue is, what are we using the money on? And frankly, after we get it under control, we should invest more. But I wouldn't until we actually get control of that and have them invest in new cars. As John was saying, the switch heaters, I mean, all the stuff that will make the system work. Because mm-hmm. right now, I mean, we shut our city down? Really?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, here's Beverly Scott. I feel like we should hear her in this Week in Review segment because she gave this amazing press conference that had a certain theatrical quality to it. She talked about a lot of things, including that this stretch of historically bad weather and heavy snowfall would have done a number on just about any transportation system in the country. Here's what she said.
Let me tell you, I've worked the new systems in Houston, the Dallas's, and all that. So yes, what happened here, it would have taken anybody down. Anybody. But let me tell you the difference. When you knew, the ability to be able to rebound because you got the resilience is there.
And let me play a cut from Paul Regan. He's the executive director of the MBTA Advisory Board, which provides public oversight of the T's budget. Here's what he said about Scott's departure yesterday.
This is not a management crisis. No one could have manage this situation better. The machines broke.
Yeah.
And there's really not a lot you can do about that.
Right.
The resources to make sure that those machines don't break have not been there for a very long time.
So, Jim, the going forward, the MBTA faces huge challenges. $9 billion in debt, a $5 billion maintenance backlog, according to the T, and now a search for a new GM. How do you characterize the way forward and what has to happen?
Well, first and foremost, I respect Paul an awful lot, but he's wrong about that. I mean, the commuter rail didn't work, as John was saying, even in good times. The subway stations, anyone who uses it knows that it stops because of signalization issues when there's nothing happening. Their pension system has gone from fully funded to 63% funded in just 5-6 years. They've been hiring hundreds of people a year recently. That's a management problem. They're in free fall, and I think they need to recognize that. Our view is, there needs to be a receivership board put into place that replaces the MBTA board. And frankly, it should be tied to the Baker administration to make them accountable for turning this around. When people say receivership, they often feel like you're taking on union contracts. That's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is something like what we did in Springfield when Springfield went to receivership in 2004. We did not break union contracts. We respected them. We did nothing with what you call Chapter 150E. I think that's the way forward. If you try to break union contracts, frankly, the Carmen's Union will shut down the system for weeks.
Right. John, very quick, I just want to get one more sort of question in about this and move on to other stories. But Paul Regan there, we were talking, we heard from him, the executive director of the advisory board. He describes Beverly Scott as a superstar and says big shoes to fill. How difficult is this search going to be?
I think it's going to be pretty difficult because there's been a tremendous amount of publicity about how badly off this system is. And I think that anybody who comes in realizes that they've got a real mountain to climb here. And so I think it's going to set the bar higher for bringing somebody in who can actually handle the problems. I think it's easy enough to get people in who can handle the problems. But there are so many basic things that need to be done here. It's a pretty daunting task, and I think it's going to make it more difficult for them to bring someone in.
Well, let's move on and talk about the overall response, citywide, statewide, to this historic run of heavy weather. First, some perspective about all this. We spoke to WBUR meteorologist David Epstein this week, and here's what he said about the winter of 2015.
This is this generation's blizzard of 78. Now, we don't have the damage from it, but in terms of the snow, the impact, the effect, the memories, the slowing down of just the way we live in society, this is it. This is what we're all sort of going through. It's the collective memory of all of us now is 2015.
2015. We've already been buried by some 80 inches of snow so far this winter with another blizzard coming. So a lot of people are struggling with long commutes, even made longer by the snow. We've talked about the T, but we should also mention the huge challenge this weather creates for drivers. And this week we spoke to Yanni Applebaum. He's senior editor of The Atlantic, and he's been writing about this, about how this kind of weather reminds us of just how fragile cities can be. Here he is.
The very things that make cities so resilient in ordinary times, all of the complicated urban infrastructure that we've built, makes them peculiarly vulnerable during catastrophic events like the snow that's been piling up for the last several weeks.
What do you think, Jim? Thoughts about the vulnerability of cities and how weeks like this remind us of that?
I completely agree with that, and I think also, in addition, what Scott Lee had to write about the city's response has some, not all of it I think I would agree with, but some of it I agree with.
This is Scott Lehigh, columnist in the Boston Globe, who basically polled listeners more or less about the response, right?
That's right. I guess one of the things that's been amazing to watch here from a driver's perspective, from a pedestrian's perspective, is this. It doesn't feel like the city has a map where they've actually looked at choke points. Hmm. That is, you know, things like intersections, merging lanes, turns, and said, we're going to clear them out. And if you just think around Boston Common, there have been two-hour traffic jams there for days on end. And it's because, for example, right where Beacon Street is that leads either to Storrow Drive East or West, it's gone from what is often a four-lane area down to two, because they not only haven't pushed the snow back, but they're allowing people to park. And you're like, haven't you guys thought about this? And I'd say also in terms of people coming to South Stations, the pedestrians, if you look at people coming over to Dewey Square and the lack of removal of snow in a high traffic area, it's really dangerous out mm-hmm. there. So it just shows the kind of fragility across all modes of transportation. I would not want to be a cyclist right now.
Yeah, I am a cyclist, and I'm not going out there on my bicycle right now. That's for sure. John, what's your overview on how the city has responded to this?
Well, apparently we all moved to Buffalo in our sleep because I didn't sign up for this at all.
Was that the mayor's fault?
It's all the mayor's
fault. That we had bad dreams.
I mean, it's really hard to judge performances here because you don't know what yardstick to use.
Yeah,
there's really no apples and oranges, or no apples and apples here. It's hard to say. I mean, I think that could a better job have been done? Yes. Is it realistic to expect that a better job was done? I'm not sure about that. But I think that that there's no question that this is also an equipment issue for the city of Boston. And this happens all the time, where they're going to go and they're going to buy a bunch of equipment, and then it's not going to snow for 2 years. But I think that they just didn't have the resources to do it. You start making choices then, and you're going to have people who are upset, and you have to decide who gets priority and who doesn't. And that's been clearly an area of disgruntlement for a lot of Boston residents.
All right. Well, I want to talk about an interesting political story here in Massachusetts this week. The state Republican Party agreed to settle a suit filed by the Tea Party-backed candidate for Governor Mark Fisher. The party will pay him $240,000. A little background here. Fisher's suit claimed that the state GOP convention, at the convention, party leaders manipulated the vote count to keep Fisher off the ballot. Eventually, the party agreed to add Fisher's name to the ballot, but he claimed that by then the damage was done. So he wins a big payout. The GOP party chairwoman, Kristen Hughes, says Mark Fisher didn't have a case, but the party agreed to settle because of mounting legal bills. So $240,000 to settle a case that the GOP says has no merit. John, thoughts about this?
I never understood why they tried to keep Mark Fisher off the ballot. Yeah. I mean, first of all, Charlie Baker won 3-1 in the primary. Second of all, Mark Fisher made Charlie Baker look downright moderate. And if I were Charlie Baker, I would have given him delegates to get him on to get him onto the ballot. This just always mystified me why they were so afraid of somebody who was going to be marginal at best getting into the primary. And so I think that they made a mistake and they're paying for it now. And I never believe people who say, you know, we were going to win this, but now we're just going to pay off so that we don't have to keep going to court. That's not a very convincing argument from my standpoint.
Yeah, the Globe covered this in an interesting way today, Jim. There was an interesting quote. Mark Fisher said that when he decided to challenge Charlie Baker in the primary, his Tea Party colleagues warned him that the liberal media would try to undermine his candidacy. But Fisher said he was frustrated not by the liberal media, but by his fellow Republicans. I don't know. Is this just a small story, or does it say something more significant about the state Republican Party? What do you think?
Well, I'd say this. That convention, to the extent that I know what was happening there, seemed like it was pretty confused. So I'd say it does say something about the state party. But I think this is one of cutting your losses. I think they'd already spent almost $200,000, and this is going to go on and on. I think what it says is that Kristen Hughes will be out raising a lot of money for quite some time to close this out.
All right. Well, that leaves us enough time to do our hubbubs, those stories that those small stories that may not have made it above the fold this week. John Carroll, what's your hubbub?
My hubbub this week, Lexington's own Dr. Jill Stein, who you may remember from the 2002 gubernatorial election. That was the big love election with Mitt Romney running against four female candidates. she was one of them. She has subsequently run for governor again in 2010. She ran for president on the Green Party ticket in 2012. Every time she has run, she's gotten fewer and fewer votes, a smaller and smaller percentage of the votes. She is contemplating another run for the presidential nominee of the Green Party. And I think that as much as it may be quixotic on her part, I think because she's one of our own, we should wish her well and hope that things work out.
All right. Jill Stein running again. Jim Sturgis, what's your hubbub?
It used to be the spur end of the grand traditions of American capitalism. That was people selling elixirs and making all kinds of promises about life-extending acai berries. Today, we seem to be, because I think the abundance in the market, we have plenty of money to burn. We've turned to things like pet rocks, you know, rocks in a box with a soft nest of hay to sleep in. Well, there is no doubt about it. Massachusetts is a strong participant in this racket. After all, what can we say about the simple beauty and uselessness of the yellow smiley face pin invented in Worcester by our own Harvey Ball? Well, we have an heir to Harvey Ball. It's Kyle Waring, a rock star entrepreneur from Manchester who started Ship Snow Yo, which offers to package up the abundance of snow in your front yard and stuff it into those 16-ounce water bottles and ship it to friends around the country who may be lacking in the white stuff this year. Let your friends know they can also order this online. We ship snow to anyone in U.S. from historic Boston, Mass. Order snow for $19.99. That's one way to shovel yourself out.
All right. In fact, we have a clip here from Kyle Waring of Manchester speaking to the Weather Channel about how he and his wife came up with this idea. Let's listen.
We were outside shoveling, and the snow is just incredible here. So we were just joking and thinking of ways to get rid of it out of our front yard, and came up with a funny, clever way to get rid of it.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's going to help clear out the streets of Boston, but maybe it could make a start. All right, well, I have another story about entrepreneurial spirit and snow. So our friends at Universal Hub flagged a Craigslist ad, which is funny because it says a lot about the times we're living in this week. So the ad is for a 2004 Audi Avant. I'll give you some stats on it. 189,000 miles, $3,500, and there are pictures of this car, sort of. Well, not really, because in fact, the picture is mostly of a huge pile of snow. There's some evidence of a car under there, a little metal trim sticking out here and there. But basically, the Craigslist ad features several pictures of the same pile of snow from different perspectives. It's indicative of what we're all dealing with. And from the ad, it's not at all clear whether you have to buy the snow for $3,500. But there it is.
Well, bring your water bottles with you anyway, right?
There you go. All right, John Carroll, Boston University Professor of Communications. Thank you. Have a great weekend.
You too, Anthony. Thanks.
And Jim Sturgis, Executive Director of the Pioneer Institute. Jim, thank you for coming in.
It's good to be with you.
And listeners, stay with us. Coming up, the man behind the election and re-election of Barack Obama, David Axelrod, is with us live in the studio. He'll take your calls. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.